Hey everybody, and welcome back to Science Decoded, your favorite science podcast. It's me, your host, Justin Dingman, and today we're going to be decoding and breaking down the science behind gene editing and therapeutic gene editing. We've got a great guest, Dr. Kiran Musunuru. He is a physician at the University of Pennsylvania, go UPenn, and the conversation is just, it's incredible. I'm just really excited for you guys to get to hear it. I want to tell you guys a little bit more about Science Decoded and Sci-Worthy News, because we know we have a lot of new friendly faces around, and not a lot of people know our message and know what we're about. Here at Science Decoded, we're the podcast off-branch or offshoot of Sci-Worthy, which is a science magazine, and we're dedicated to decoding and breaking down recent contemporary science, all the latest breakthroughs in technology and science and discoveries and things that are building on top of other things and making drugs and all these other crazy things. Like, that's what we're watching for. We ourselves are scientists, and we have to be ingrained in the community, and we have to be able to continue our education and continue to learn. And so as we do this naturally through our career, we also want to be able to educate you guys on what's going on. We want to be able to share these tips and these tricks on how to understand how the science language works and how to become a little more science literate and begin to question things and ask questions and answer questions for yourself. Being a self-sufficient learner is the way that we all became scientists. We're very glad you're here to join us, and just sit back, relax, and enjoy two nerds talking about science. So some Sci-Worthy news, we have one new article up by Rachel Holland. It's titled Using Artificial Intelligence to Diagnose Autism in the Womb. And I think it's a great article. You guys should definitely go to our website, check it out. You can see some of our old podcasts and any other new articles that we've got posted up. As you guys know, one of the most frustrating questions as an undergraduate, one of the most elusive questions as a graduate, and still one of the most confusing questions to answer as a professional academic, is how do you read science papers, and how do you efficiently get all the information you need out of these crazy pictures and words and numbers and sentences that don't make any sense? That's why I started this new segment called Tips and Tricks. So if you look back to our previous podcast, you can catch the first half of this, but I'm going to cover another half on this one. So after you've kind of picked the topics of science that you're really interested in, and the topics of science you really want to dive deeper, you should begin to read the abstract. I think that's the most important way to see what you need to see and get what you need to get in a very succinct fashion. It's just 8 sentences, and they cover the main points of the introduction, the methods, the data, the discussion, and the conclusion. And if you get really confused, and if you get even more lost in the abstract, the last few sentences always have the results in context, the conclusion, and maybe like future work, like what they plan on doing with it. I recommend, you know, starting with the last 3 sentences of the abstract. It's something that I myself have used, and it's really helped me out in my career. So if there's something inside the abstract, like words or terms you don't understand or you don't know, or things you have questions on, take notes on that. And then I guarantee you can look that up and find that on the internet, whether it's at Khan Academy or YouTube or Wikipedia. I mean, we use that stuff all the time in science. We forget concepts, something's mentioned in a paper that we're not quite sure on, but we have enough background information to Google it, read the information, absorb the information, and then take it and use it for what we need to. So today we're going to be talking about some of the recent developments in the sciences of gene editing. But before we get started, as always, I wanted to give you guys a refresher on some important concepts. So in biology, the most important concept to us for this episode today is going to be what's called the central dogma. And the central dogma is just this idea that biology has these 3 main parts. So you have DNA, which stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. It makes up your genetic code. And the way it's coded is like 4 bases, A, G, T, and C. I'm sure many of you guys at some point in your life have heard this and are familiar with it. The DNA, or the genetic code for an organism, carries all of the information for that living system. The same way a computer carries all of its informations in ones and zeros, the DNA carries all of its informations in A's, G's, T's, and C's. Because of this, DNA is extremely stable, because we don't want our genetic code to be easily rewritten, erased, changed around. We want it to stay consistent. DNA in our body, though, is transcribed into what's called RNA. It's another biological molecule that's a lot like DNA. And it's changed from DNA into RNA through a biological process known as transcription. So you have an original DNA strand, you have the process of transcription going on, and then your products are the original DNA strand and the new RNA. And RNA has many roles within biology, but genetically it works as this thing called a messenger, where that has the actual hard input code for the proteins to make more proteins out of. All that you have to know is that your DNA is transcribed into your RNA, and your RNA is translated into proteins by other proteins in your body. Proteins are these special molecules inside our body, which are useful in all of the processes that we need to live. And they're involved in building, maintaining, and destroying all parts of our body, even DNA and RNA itself. Proteins help the body execute all of the necessary functions that we need in order to live. And since genes, or little bits of DNA, are what ultimately lead to the production of these important tools, if we can change a gene, manipulate it, add some more stuff into it, take some stuff out of it, with the intention to make an organism change its proteins, we might be able to completely change what's going on with that organism, cure disease, change their hair color, change their eye color. There are things that we can actively affect by changing the gene and letting the body do the work. Now, as to how we change that gene, well, that's a different question. There's this special protein. I'm sure you guys have heard it in science news. It's very big right now, and it's something that I myself am even getting the chance to study. It's called CRISPR-Cas9. CRISPR-Cas9 is an example of a protein whose job it is to interact with DNA and get rid of bad DNA, because it was originally used by bacterial immune systems to find and destroy DNA that had been infected from a virus. And this protein, it uses its shape and special chemistry to read, bind, and cut specific strands of DNA. What makes CRISPR so special is that it can be used to identify very specific sequences of DNA. Therefore, we're able to control exactly where or what in the DNA we're doing. The ability to find these specific sequences is the most important aspect of CRISPR, as we have developed ways to make it find specific sequence of interest to research, and when combined with other proteins, we can make other changes to the DNA. However, cutting it does allow researchers an opportunity to put in more genetic information where the cut happens. When we get back, we'll be speaking to Dr. Kiran Musunuru on his two papers entitled In Utero CRISPR-Mediated Therapeutic Editing of Metabolic Genes, and reduced lipid levels within vivo CRISPR-Cas9 base editing of ANGPTL3. Welcome back to Coders. Today we're going to be speaking with Dr. Kiran Musunuru about two of his recent papers titled In Utero CRISPR-Mediated Therapeutic Editing of Metabolic Genes and Reduced Blood Lipid Levels Within Vivo CRISPR-Cas9 Base Editing of the Gene ANGPTL3. Kiran, thanks for joining us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, your job, your primary responsibilities in your field, and kind of give the spiel to anybody who might be interested in what you do?
Absolutely. And let me say first, thanks so much for having me on, Justin. So I think of myself as a cardiologist, a geneticist, and a gene editor. And so let me unwind that a bit. I'm a cardiologist. I'm a physician. I still actively practice. In fact, at the time that we're interviewing this right now, I'm actually on clinical service taking care of patients in the hospital. So just in case we get interrupted, I might get called away for an emergency, although that's very unlikely. But what it means is that as a cardiologist, I take care of patients who have heart disease, who have problems with the heart. And that can range from coronary artery disease, which is the cause of heart attacks, which is the leading cause of death worldwide, a very, very common situation. In their lifetimes, on the order of 1 in 2 men will have a heart attack in their lifetime, and 1 in 3 women will have a heart attack in their lifetime. So it's not an unusual condition by any means. Other types of diseases I study, or as well as take care of patients, include heart failure or conditions that lead to heart failure, so structural problems with the heart, as well as rhythm problems. So it's a constellation of different types of diseases that affect the heart, and I study mostly coronary disease, but I have branched out and study the others as well. And then as a cardiologist, as a clinician, as a physician, I take care of patients generally with any of those conditions and are suffering from one of these conditions, do what I can to get them better and get them back home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the cardiology part of me. The geneticist part of me really speaks to me as a scientist. I study the genetics of heart disease, of cardiovascular disease, trying to identify novel genes that influence the risk for a particular person either getting disease or maybe being protected from disease in both directions, predisposition versus protection. In my career so far, I've been fortunate enough to identify a reasonably large number of candidate genes and have drilled down on a few of them and demonstrated that they do indeed directly influence the risk of heart disease and represent therapeutic targets that can serve as potential new ways of treating diseases or preventing diseases. And then the gene editing part of me, this is a bit newer, although I've actually been working on gene editing before CRISPR came to the popular attention. So with previous generations of gene editing tools. So, you know, by this point, actually more than a decade, I've been working with gene editing tools to study disease, but more recently as a therapeutic approach in and of themselves. The idea is if there is a therapeutic target gene that you know influences or causes a disease, can you use gene editing to modify that gene in such a way that you treat or prevent the disease? So those are the three parts of me. And as you can hopefully tell, they're intertwined. And so what I do in my laboratory as a principal investigator is very much tied to the patients that I see in the clinical setting in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at the title of both of these papers, you know, a few words stick out to me, like CRISPR, blood lipid levels, therapeutic editing, base editing. So can you kind of tell us what the aims of these studies were?
Sure. So these were proof of concept studies. And it wasn't so much that we were trying to address a hypothesis, which is sort of the traditional scientific model. This was really more translational in nature. The idea was, could we demonstrate in an animal model that we could modify a disease process by editing a particular gene? So one of the papers you mentioned was more focused on blood lipid levels, but which really mean cholesterol and triglycerides. Mm-hmm. So if you have your cholesterol checked, that's exactly what we're talking about, cholesterol. We know that cholesterol and to an extent triglycerides, the fat content in the blood that goes along with cholesterol, we know that there are strong risk factors and causal risk factors for heart disease, in particular coronary artery disease and heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that if you reduce somebody's cholesterol levels, that is a good thing. This is why millions of people are on statin drugs. But that means taking a pill every day, and there are other medications that lower cholesterol levels as well, and they entail injections that you take every few weeks, which is a bit more cumbersome. And also is quite pricey. So, you know, they're not necessarily used to anywhere near the same extent that pills like statins are. But these are different types of therapeutic approaches. Now, the issue of gene editing is you could potentially identify a gene that's linked to cholesterol levels and then use editing to modify that gene in a permanent way. In one of the studies you mentioned, the focus was on the gene ANGPTL3, which is an abbreviation for angiopoietin-like 3. And without really diving into the mechanism of how it works, what we know is that the protein ANGPTL3, its effects are to increase cholesterol levels in the blood. And so if you can turn off that gene or otherwise block it, you will reduce the cholesterol levels in the blood. And if you do that in a person, you will reduce their risk of a heart attack because there is a direct causal relationship between this particular gene and cholesterol. So conceptually, it seems very simple. Hey, just turn off the gene or block the protein. And it actually kind of turns out that way. So there is a monoclonal antibody drug that was just approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration earlier this year that binds to the ANGPTL3 protein in the blood and blocks its action and essentially clears it out of the blood. You're preventing the protein from being made, and that has the same effect as a monoclonal antibody in the blood binding the protein. It's essentially turning things off, and that will bring cholesterol levels down. Those are in clinical trials. They have not been approved for broad clinical use yet, although if they pan out in the coming years, you can expect those to be therapeutic options. But I'm more interested in gene editing. Gene editing, the idea is that you can work on things at the DNA level. You can turn off the gene in a way that is permanent. You can't really do that with proteins in the blood because new protein is always being made. You can't really do that with messenger RNA because new messenger RNA molecules are always being made, transcribed in the DNA. But if you make a permanent genetic change, it has the potential to be a once and done therapy. It has the potential to be permanent. So the question I asked in the one paper with ANGPTL3s is, could we deliver CRISPR to make a specific change that would turn off the ANGPTL3 gene in the liver, and in doing so, reduce cholesterol as well as triglycerides? In the second study, we did something a little different. The focus was more on not so much a cardiovascular disease, ironically, since I'm a cardiologist, it doesn't mean I'm necessarily restricted to just working on cardiovascular diseases. That's the fun of science. You can go where your imagination and your interests take you. But the focus was more on a biochemical disorder, a rare disease called tyrosinemia, where the liver cells have an enzymatic defect because of gene mutations that prevent them from breaking down the amino acid tyrosine properly. And because they're not able to break down tyrosine, you end up with toxic molecules, metabolites, that don't get cleared properly and kill the liver cells. So we asked, can we use CRISPR or a version of CRISPR to modify the genetic process that leads to this abnormal breakdown of tyrosine? And the answer is yes, we could. And the other wrinkle to that particular study is that because this is a disease where damage is already occurring to the liver while the patient is in the womb, in utero. Now, they don't die in the womb because the mom, through the placental circulation, can clear out toxic metabolites, can fulfill the function of the liver, keep the fetus's liver alive. And so our proof of concept study was to use a mouse model, again, in this case, a mouse model of tyrosinemia. The fetuses do okay while they're in utero. And what we found is that if we went in early, and by which I mean we actually did the equivalent of fetal surgery, but instead actually did fetal gene editing, if we could access the fetus, and the way we do that is essentially like a partial C-section, if you will, where you open the uterus and you take each fetus, it's in its own amniotic sac, and it turns out that there is a blood vessel called the vitellin vein that you can see on the amniotic sac, and it offers a direct route into the fetal liver. And so we found that when we injected viral vectors that encoded CRISPR, it took it right into the fetal liver and knocked out the target gene. And then what we found is that when the mice were born, they survived. They did not die. And not only did they survive, they thrived. So you can treat this tyrosinemia with a medication that, interestingly enough, is a repurposed pesticide. It works, but it's not the best way to address the condition. What we found is if we use gene editing while still in the womb, in utero, the babies that were born, they survived, they grew into adulthood, and they thrived, and they greatly outperformed, that's the right word to use here, the mice that only started receiving the drug, you know, in their water effectively, after they were born. So treating condition genetically and going early was unequivocally beneficial. So those were the concepts that we were trying to prove in these two studies. And together, I think they offer a strong argument for genetic therapies, gene editing therapies that might someday be used in human patients.
Yeah, I mean, those are some impressive results. And I think it's something you can be proud of, stepping in and making those assertions based off your data. You know, one question I always have, especially when we talk about gene editing, is we have to be conscious of off-pathway effects or knocking out or changing genes or shifting reading frames or, you know, something just crazy that you could do to the genetic code. How are you able to confidently assess your results in light of the complexity of the problem you're trying to solve?
Absolutely. So there are really two angles to this question. The first is, how do we reduce off-target edits, or even if they're not off-target, even if they're in the right location, have unintended consequences? So you mentioned, mm-hmm. You alluded to deletions or insertions or big, large-scale changes that, you know, like perhaps don't affect just the gene you're targeting. So you can have both off-target effects in the sense that you're hitting a gene somewhere else in the genome, entirely unintended, or you can hit the gene you want to hit, but you can have unintended consequences in the local area. So you have to be mindful of both of those. So one angle to go after it is to use tools that are more precise. And so when we talk about CRISPR, there are actually three generations of tools of CRISPR. There's the original CRISPR tool that will make double-strand breaks in DNA. And the way you make changes in the DNA is actually dependent on errors in the repair process. Ironically, it's not the actual cutting of the DNA, it's the cell's attempt to patch up the DNA after it's broken. And you're actually depending on it making mistakes. And so you get these small insertions or deletions that mm-hmm. then scramble the gene's activity, which if you're trying to knock out the gene, that's great. It works really well. And in our earlier studies, done a few years back before the two studies that we've been talking about today, we used this original CRISPR version 1.0, if you will, and it worked quite well. But it was a bit uncontrolled because we couldn't really, you know, determine or fix exactly which types of mutations we get. We would get, you know, each cell would have a different type of mutation or a different mutation, a different length of insertion or deletion. It worked great to knock down the gene, but there was definitely the potential for unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm. When we say insertion and deletion here, we're talking about, you know, inserting genetic information or accidentally deleting genetic information, or, you know, just messing up part of the process that transcribes genetic information into the proteins exactly. that are active in our body.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Now, version 2.0 is what is known as base editing. And so this technology, it's based on CRISPR. Instead of making double-strand breaks, you can go to a specific location and actually, instead of breaking the DNA, you're making a chemical modification of a DNA base. So turning it from one letter into another. It's much more precise. And because it's much more precise, there's much less potential for unintended consequences, either at the place that you are targeting, the gene you are trying to affect, or elsewhere in the genome. So it's just intrinsically cleaner. And then there's a third generation that's even more recent called prime editing. And so these newer forms of CRISPR actually offer a safer way, I would argue, of doing the things that you want to do, changing genes for therapeutic purposes. So that's one dimension of addressing the off-target edits. You asked another aspect of it, which is, how do you know if you're making off-target edits? And so there are a whole variety of techniques that have been developed to assess where else in the genome might you inadvertently be making changes. And so it offers us the opportunity to say, well, let us design our CRISPR system. Let's go to certain locations and screen them and see, using these techniques, which one gives us the cleanest profile, which one has the least off-target effects. And that's the one you would go forward with into, say, drug development.
So what are some of the challenges and benefits associated with gene editing, both like in organisms with lots and lots of cells and just maybe with a zygote or a fertilized egg or a single cellular organism?
Yeah, so the challenge with a multicellular organism, like a live breathing human being, is that you have all these cells and organs. And let's say you want to turn off a gene in the liver. You want to be able to hit most of the cells in the liver. Otherwise, you're not going to get a full knockdown or turning off of the gene. And it's not trivial. to actually get something like CRISPR into most, if not all, of the cells in the liver. You need specific technologies, delivery technologies, to get CRISPR in there. But these are far from perfect. They're getting to be pretty good, but they're not perfect. They're not going to hit exactly 100% of the liver cells you want to target. And they're not going to necessarily hit only those cells, you know, other organs. An intense amount of effort is going into making these more precise in terms of where they target and how well they target. But that's the number one challenge if you're talking about an adult patient. We've already talked about another challenge, which is safety, and that's more along the lines of the off-target editing. Now, you bring up the idea of doing it in a zygote. And, you know, on the surface, it's attractive because if you're trying to make a change, you're talking about a single cell. And it's all or nothing. You make the change, and then it's in that cell. And then once that cell starts dividing and then giving rise to an organism, all the cells in that organism, whether it's a live breathing human being or whether it's an animal model or whatnot, they'll carry that change. And so on the surface, it's attractive. But it also brings up, especially when you're talking about human beings, all these fraught ethical issues, right? And, you know, you could have a whole podcast or like several episodes of a podcast on that issue alone. So I'm not going to really dig too deep into it. But the whole idea that, you know, you might do this, you know, to make designer babies, to use the colloquialism, right? To confer traits that are considered desirable by the parents or whoever it is who's doing the designing. You know, that brings up a lot of concerns and controversy and debate, as it properly should. Even if you have the noblest of intentions and you're talking about trying to improve the health of a child or even cure a disease in a future child, it's tricky because, you know, it's if you're talking about a single cell zygote, there's always the choice not to actually have that become a human being. And so can you really be said to be curing a disease? So without, you know, getting really, you know, deep into the weeds here, there are some attractive features of zygote editing, and it's turned out to be incredibly useful if you're talking about animal models to study disease. But the general consensus among the scientific community, and even the general public, at least at the present time, is that this is something we should not do when we're talking about actual
disease. Mm-hmm. How do your results kind of contribute to the bigger picture of clinical and therapeutic applications of gene editing? And how far away do you think we are from using gene editing as a type of treatment that you can just go get a shot in the doctor's office for?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's very much on my mind and other people's minds right now, because there are actually clinical trials now ongoing where people are receiving CRISPR-based therapies in their bodies. So the proof of concept work in the two papers we've discussed today show that you can tackle cardiovascular disease, you can tackle biochemical disorders. Certainly, it seems to work very well in mouse mm-hmm. models, and that just provides energy to have drug companies develop CRISPR-based therapeutics that will tackle cardiovascular disease or biochemical disorders or a whole variety of diseases in patients. And so to give you an example of one such situation, you know, cardiovascular disease, there is a trial ongoing now by a company called Intellia, where they are tackling an unusual form of heart failure called transthyretin amyloidosis. To make a long story short, there's a protein made in the liver called transthyretin. And in certain situations, that protein, when it's secreted into the bloodstream, it starts to form clumps, it aggregates, and those aggregates end up in the heart muscle and they gum up the heart muscle and eventually cause the heart to fail. They're using gene editing to turn off the transthyretin gene in the liver. And so if you turn it off at its source, then there's, you know, not so much protein in the blood in the first place. And that means that you can't form aggregates of that protein. And that means those aggregates don't end up in the heart. And the hope is that not only does it stop the disease in its tracks if you're starting to get heart failure, but it might even reverse the heart failure if some of those aggregates that are already in the heart start to clear out. And so this trial is ongoing. It started late last year and several patients have been dosed. And in fact, Intellia, very shortly, this month being June of 2021, I've actually just announced that they're going to report out the results of that clinical trial at a scientific conference. And so it'll be very interesting to see how effective their attempt to use CRISPR in patients with transthyretin amyloidosis, how well they will respond, how successful CRISPR is at actually turning off the gene and reducing the amount of protein in the bloodstream. And
so this all sounds super exciting. I mean, just the fact that we're this close to actually getting it approved.
Yeah, I mean, it's looking promising so far. It'll take a few years before these things get approved. I mean, clinical trials do take time.
Are there any drawbacks or downsides of this type of therapy?
Yeah, so if you're talking about, say, you know, cardiovascular disease or something along those lines, you know, one arguable drawback is that, you know, its key feature could be viewed as a bug, right? So the idea that you're trying to make a permanent change in the genome, you could take the opposite view and say, well, isn't that risky? You're making a permanent change and, you know, what if something goes wrong? Then there's no possibility of, you know, reversing that. Whereas with a pill you take every day, well, you stop taking the pill if you get a bad side effect. Or even injections you take every few weeks, just, you know, stop taking the injections and the therapeutic will clear out of your blood in a couple of weeks and then you'll be fine. That presupposes that the gene editing that we'll be doing in the future is in fact irreversible. And I would argue that with some of the newer forms of CRISPR, well, if you can make a specific change, change one letter into another, it's probably going to be quite feasible to go back in and reverse that change if you want to. It's a little bit science fiction-ish, but you know, that's not outside the realm of possibility. But that is one concern that's raised. I think that's more a theoretical concern if you've thought carefully about, you know, what gene you're targeting and if you're treating patients who have very serious disease and, you know, are either going to be very, very sick if you don't treat them or potentially going to die if you don't treat them. You know, I think, you know, you got to weigh the benefits and the risks, and the benefits could very well greatly outweigh the risk. The other potential issue is interestingly, like a moral hazard. So let's say you're able to treat someone with gene editing and it greatly reduces their future risk of having a heart attack. Does that give them license to say, oh, I'm protected from heart disease, and so I'm not going to worry as much about exercise and good diet and things of that sort, which are, you know, a very important aspect of preventing heart disease. And so it might be arguably a little counterproductive.
So what are some misconceptions that come alongside gene editing and gene editing therapy?
Yeah, I think some misconceptions is that it could be used to alter some things that are very complex, whether it's complex diseases like type 2 diabetes, where we don't have a full understanding of exactly how the disease occurs and where you can't really point to a single gene where if you turn it off or turn it on, you're going to magically cure the disease. You know, like psychiatric disorders, for example, very, very complex, probably many, many genes in play. Thinking that you're going to be able to edit just one gene or a couple genes and fix the problem, it's probably unrealistic. Now, you know, there are some applications, you know, I mentioned heart attack and cholesterol genes. If you can turn off just one cholesterol gene, it looks like it will actually be able to protect against heart disease. But most diseases are not like that. And then, you know, if you even go beyond diseases, I think there's a, you know, there's some misperception out there that, you know, going back to the idea of designer babies, like, could you enhance intelligence or athletic ability by using gene editing? And those things are so complex. You'd have to change probably hundreds or even thousands of genes to get really, you know, like smart kids or very athletically talented kids or something like that.
Yeah. And at this point, we're even just struggling to get on the market this idea that we can edit one gene effectively and safely, let alone thousands with so many maps of interactions.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I always like to ask my guests at the end of every podcast one final question. You know, Kieran, why'd you come on today? Is there anything you want to tell our listeners, you know, about your job, about your love for science, about yourself?
Yeah, well, I feel like I'm living a dream. You know, I mentioned, you know, the various aspects of myself. You know, I'm a physician, but I'm also a scientist. And so being in a position where I can treat patients and learn from patients and help them recover or prevent their diseases. But then being able to also be in the laboratory and using really cutting edge technologies and actually be able to use that in service of those very same patients that I'm seeing in the clinical setting. I mean, it's just intoxicating. It's so exciting to be able to go from, you know, people say bench to bedside, but it's actually both directions. Bedside, you know, you actually study patients and you learn things about the genetics of disease and identify new therapeutic targets. Then you go to the bench and you better understand how those target genes work and then develop, you know, new types of therapeutics like gene editing or whatnot. in the laboratory, and then you take that back to the bedside, take it back to patients and actually learn to see. It's coming full circle. And it's, you know, it's amazing that we live in an era where it's actually possible that one person like myself, and I don't want to give you the impression that I'm doing it single-handed. I have a large team of people associated with my laboratory and collaborators and so forth who are making it all possible. But what one, you know, what one dedicated effort can actually traverse the entire cycle in a relatively short period of time, you know, on the scale of, you know, just several years.
Yeah, and it is amazing the speed at which technology and science seem to advance. And how things are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to produce and to work with these days too. Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for your candid answers. We really appreciate your job, what you do for a living, and the fact that you're out there helping on the front lines, just trying to figure out answers to some of these deep diseases and genetic questions. And so, you know, from all of us, we just want to thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Justin. Thanks so much again for having me on.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Alien and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.